good morning. And today's the third day of Sishin, and it's Saturday. And I got a text from my wife, which wasn't an emergency, but it just said that Britain is leaving the EU, which is shot all my plans for retiring in Spain. Because I've got a British passport, I was born in the UK, so I've got a British passport, but that means that you can't live in Europe anymore. Or work there. So I'm perturbed. I'm sure there are bigger concerns than that, but don't know why I bring that up. I thought it was just it's like one of those things sometimes, you know, like you're in Sishin and then you get out and then there were some big times, some big things I think happened before. Elvis, not Elvis died, he died during one session.
Michael Jackson.
That's right. He died during a session. This is the third day of Sishin, and I was kind of reflecting on the schedule. We have a schedule that has time points during the day, and they're all held together by either bells or clappers or the horn being struck. And they've been around a long time, from the first monasteries, and they're all sounds that indicate that we need to be somewhere and doing something. And sometimes, sometimes what might appear on the schedule, and you might hear a horn call, I think it was like with the exercise period, it was 15 minutes early because the schedule said something different. And the training in Sishin is just to be like one of Pavlov's dogs. When you hear a sound, is that you drop what you're doing, you run to the source of the sound. And I remember doing this in the Zen Mountain Monastery when I was Jikyo, for some reason I thought the alarm had gone off in the morning at whatever time it was, 3:30, raced up, rang down, hit all the bells, and woke everybody up, and I was kind of coming out, and the head monk comes out and says, "What are you doing? Do you know what time this is?" And it was something like 2 a.m. or something in the morning. I just hadn't checked the time. I don't know, I was an automatic pilot, and everybody was up like about 3 hours early, and everyone went back to bed. I was very shamefaced. I don't know, I just didn't look at the clock. I just got up there and everyone, of course, got up. but mostly, it performs with the schedule, which is important because, especially for organising activities, that it's usually best to know when things happen. So, but that time period just means that we can let go of deciding what we need to be doing and when. And like most things in Sishin, it kind of relieves us from the need to take care of those most basic fundamentals about should I do this or should I do that. So sort of today I'll talk about the koan from the gateless gate. This one's called, it's an old classic. This one's a Bodhidharma, pacifies the mind, case 41. And so this koan has two main protagonists in there. One is a Bodhidharma, who is what we call the first Zen ancestor, and he's, when we recite the lineage, his Chinese, Japanese transliteration is Bodhidharma, and so when we translate the lineage, you'll hear his name, Bodhidharma Daisho. And the second ancestor, who's in here as well, is Eka, Taisho Eka, Kaisa Ika Dayo show. And so this is a kind of a teaching story or a koan between the two of them. Bodhidharma is an interesting character. He's, so this is set 500 or so, 550 AD in CE in China. And Bodhidharma is an Indian Brahmin who came over to China. He sailed around, I don't know my geography, but anyway, from India to China. And then his first appearances with Emperor Wu, who's the king of China at the time, or that part of China, and he has an audience with Emperor Wu, who's a famous supporter of Buddhism. And his first encounter, when the emperor is, you know, very very proud to have Bodhidharma, who's this famous Indian monk, come over, and he has an audience with him, and the king tells him all the things he's been doing for Buddhism in China, and he's ordained you know, thousands of monks and built many many temples. And he says, "What merit have I gained from this?" And because merit is a Buddhist concept, or maybe a Hindu concept as well, about gaining up for like spiritual goodies, or you know, piling up that kind of spiritual riches. And you know, when you do good works, then you expect good things to happen. You know, good karma, building up good karma. And Bodhidharma just says to him, you know, no merit whatsoever. All the stuff you've done, no merit whatsoever. It's a little shocking. And you shouldn't really be saying that thing to an emperor. You should be saying, very well done. and then he says, what is the highest meaning of the holy truths? What is the highest meaning of Buddhism? And Bodhidharma says, vast emptiness, nothing holy. So nothing sacred at all. And the emperor, more perturbed, says, well, who are you standing here before me telling me this? And Bodhidharma says, I do not know. And then he decides that time is not right for Buddhism in China, so he crosses the Yangtze River on a reed, apparently. It seemed very light. And then he heads off to Shaolin Monastery and sits facing the wall in a cave there for 9 years. And other legends, that's how Kung Fu was developed. That's where it started in Shaolin, about keeping the monks active. It was also the stories around him that he don't quite know where he died. There are some stories that say he was poisoned by some of the people. Other monks around at the time who were jealous of his teaching style, because he was a bit of a rigorous kind of character and wasn't backward and coming forward. And then they say he had very bad teeth, and they were because he tried to be poisoned on numerous attempts, and in the last attempt he just gave up for that, whatever, and drank the poison. And so, but there's another story about him that. He went back to China. He had enough of the teaching and decided he wanted to go home. And apparently one of his students met him somewhere in the mountains of Turkestan, and he was only wearing one sandal. And apparently he went back and died in China. And then when the monk who had met this guy in China came back and told his disciples that he had actually met him and had only had one sandal, then they opened up the grave, his grave, and there was one sandal sitting in there, but no Bodhidharma. It's a good story. Anyway, in this case, Bodhidharma is in Shaolin Monastery, and he's sitting in his cave. And so the story starts. So the main case. So Bodhidharma faced the wall sick an ancestor standing in the snow, cut off his arm, and said, "Your disciple's mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please put it to rest." Bodhidharma said, "Bring me your mind, and I will put it to rest." The sick an ancestor said, "I have searched for my mind, but I cannot find it." And Bodhidharma said, "I have completely put it to rest for you." And there's a comment on this from Master Wu Min, who put this book together. The snaggle-toothed foreigner came complacently 100,000 miles across the sea. It was like raising waves where there is no wind. Finally, he cobbled together a single disciple and a crippled one at that. And there's a verse too. So coming from the west and directly pointing, all the trouble springs from this. The jungle of monks at sixes and sevens is your fault after all. So this little story here has a bit more to it too. So that Bodhidharma is sitting facing the wall, it's doing zazen. And the story is that the second ancestor, Hideka, arrives after being told of Bodhidharma, who's practicing in the monastery somewhere. That this teacher Bodhidharma is in Shaolin Monastery. So he travels a long way to get there, and when he gets there, he finds Bodhidharma, you know, facing the wall and not wanting to talk to him, and kind of, "Hello, here I am, I've come a long way." And Bodhidharma won't talk to him, so he beseeches him to accept him as a student. But Bodhidharma will have nothing of it. So he stands I'll read you the little story here. So it was winter, day and night. Eka stood before Bodhidharma's cave, beseeching him for instruction. The old barbarian, however, sat in zazen and paid no attention. One night there was a snowstorm, but Eka stood there unmoving and the snow reached his knees. Finally, Bodhidharma said, "You've been standing there a long time in the snow. What is it that you want?" And Eka said, "I beseech you, Master, open the gate of the Dharma and save all of us beings." Bodhidharma said, "The incomparable truth of the Buddhas can only be attained by constant striving, practicing what cannot be practiced, bearing the unbearable. How can you, with your small virtue and wisdom, and your easygoing and conceited mind, dare to aspire to the true teaching?" With this, it is said, Eka drew a knife and cut off his hand and presented it to Bodhidharma, who relented at last and accepted him as a disciple. Quite a story. And it's like a lot of very interesting, I guess, points in this koan, and that's the story too. You've got Eka, who has, I guess, a really, really deep desire to put his mind to rest, to really, really know what his life is about, to really get right to the depths of this strange, you know, ephemeral existence that we have and are. And so he goes off to see Bodhidharma, and the way that it's mythical really, but the way the story is presented is that Bodhidharma will have nothing to do with him. And in some ways, I think Bodhidharma is an old monk, and he really doesn't want students at all. You know, it's his personality. That's why he's in a cave. He's not exactly down there with the party animals, and there are lots of different kinds of teachers. Some who really like lots of people and like to be in the cities, and some like Bodhidharma, who probably didn't want any students at all and is up in a cave. So he's not specifically waiting for Eka, you know, as in some kind of magic beacon on the hill. And there are probably hundreds of Bodhidharmas out there who never had students or actually succeeded in driving them away before they cut off their arms. And but this particular one has a lineage. So this Bodhidharma, so Eka has such a strong desire that, and Bodhidharma basically just puts him off, you know, you know, he basically throws abuse at him. This aspect is really hard. You know, you with your small, conceited mind, how dare you aspire to the true teaching? Imagine that, you walked all that way, I don't know how many weeks, across bandit-ridden territory, and then you're standing in the snow, and we won't talk to you, and then, you know, you get that terrible criticism. And so that's kind of one point, and it's like, it's kind of allegorical, but it's also that, yeah, it's kind of a lesson for us. This is something that he really, really wants, and he's not put off by it. And that's kind of the struggle there. And then he cuts off his arm. Now, some stories say that Eka was actually a general, so he actually had already lost his arm. So, and really, no. Probably unlikely. Probably would have died. So, but who knows, you know, I guess that's the saying in some of the Eastern traditions that removing fingers or limbs as a sign of I guess a great desire, or there's a story that Eka Roshi relates about meeting a nun in a monastery in Korea, I think it is, and she has her ring from the top of her ring finger severed, and she says that her parents he says the nun who presides at the Kuan Yin Temple in Honolulu is missing part of one finger. She tells the story that her parents in Hong Kong would not allow her to become a nun, so she severed the end of her ring finger by way of indicating that she had no intention of marrying. Thus they were persuaded. I mean, it's quite an intense thing to do, to actually, you know, physically self-harm, to show that, you know, this is true. This is what I need to do. So that's the part of that tremendous drive to really clarify your life. And that desire can, I guess, conjure up tremendous will to act and to overcome, you know, huge obstacles. You know, when we really want something, nothing stands in our way. And this is kind of like with no hope of achieving anything either. It's like that we don't know we're going to get there or do it. And I think about all those kind of tragic stories that about you know, refugees coming in from Syria or Africa, and the tremendous courage it takes to get off on that journey, and the numbers who don't make it. And suffering that we, you know, can hardly comprehend. And you know, part of that is being clear about what is important to us. Having that direction of saying, well, this is what I want to do. And then, and it's amazing kind of that commitment is when you can commit to something, it's you know, sometimes we think, you know, committing to something is puts a whole kind of wall around us, means we can't do this and we can't do that, but in many ways it really frees us to focus on one thing. And a bit like, you know, the classic description of getting married, and it's like, oh God. But you know, anything you commit to, I found it when I was at the Zen Center, like thinking, okay, well, you know, I kind of gave up my aspirations to have a real job, and I'd done my training as an engineer, and I got my graduate degree and everything, and kind of giving that away was actually it was a really tough decision, but it's like one of those things where it's just that finding something that's really important. And means cutting off the kind of other distractions, and then just focusing on that one thing. So So in this case, the one thing that which we all have in common is the aspiration for waking up. That's why we're here. And that's why this koan basically speaks to that energy in all of us, that aspiration in all of us. So basically that committing to the path. And in some ways we think committing to the path is like, it's this long, long-term goal per se. But really, and in terms of our direct experience, it's basically committing to this experience, to being alive for this experience. Committing to the breath. When you think about the people who have inspired us, sometimes the stories about people attaining goals and that it's kind of wonderful on its own thing, but it's really that drive, I guess, that single-mindedness and willing to sacrifice, I guess, some things. And so in Zen, it's like, we're not sure about sacrificing, all kinds of external things, but we're starting to sacrifice, our opinions, our desires to be right. Which is a wonderful session, a wonderful practice, because, it's like all our own. We all have to get along for this period, and we all have to walk in the same way, and we all have to eat in the same way, and we have all this kind of stuff that means that we have to lay down our own particular ways of doing things. And we throw away in this journey, or that this, we also throw away our security. This is the ways that we normally protect ourselves. And it's also sometimes this con in a sense is it's got this kind of heroic, real heroic element, which is the when you take the seat, there is that kind of heroic element of sitting down and doing battle with the thoughts in your mind. There's that kind of raising that energy as well. But it's also got that other aspect, which is really kind of a softening. Letting go of what we hold most dear. And they're really the two sides of this practice. One we really require that kind of determination, because all kinds of things come up, and we bring up that energy to practice. But there's also that kind of opening, to the possibility that life just as it is enough. I was reflecting on the. Does everyone know the story of the selfish giant? Oscar Wilde? I remember hearing as a kid, it was on the. I don't know if they still do, but I think it was at 7 a.m. on Saturday mornings or something. There was a story hour for kids, and there was the Golden Palomino and the Gossamer Lump. We hear about 27 peanut butter sandwiches, I think, that went off to New York with his dog in the suitcase. If you haven't heard it, you should Google it. Cost him a while. But anyway, that selfish giant was on there too. And it's a beautiful story about, I guess, giving up on your own, the own stuff that you kind of hang on to. And the story of the selfish giant is that he's a giant who has a beautiful garden. He's created this beautiful garden. It's amazing. And he goes off and sees a friend of his, the other giant who lives in the mountains. And he's there for 7 years. And as they say, the selfish giant didn't have much to say, but it took him that long to say it. And when he got back, he found that all the children from the neighbouring village were in the garden and were playing. And he's like, they're not allowed to come into my garden. This is my garden. My garden is my garden. And he brings a great big rock from the mountain and smashes it up and makes a huge wall around it, and nobody can get in. And then the winter sets into the garden and doesn't leave. And gets a bit kind of perturbed that winter just stays year after year after year. And then at some point, some of the children knock a little hole in the wall and they're able to get inside. And as soon as they come in, the spring returns and the giant wakes up and he no longer hears the hail crashing onto the slates, and he looks out and he sees the children playing in the garden, and spring has returned to the garden, and it's a beautiful sight. And he can't believe it. And he rushes out, and of course the children are and they disappear. But when they see that the giant doesn't mean any harm, they come back and spring returns to the garden. And then in the corner of the garden is still winter is still there, and there's a tree that's laden down with snow, and he looks close, and there's a little boy who's standing underneath the tree, and he can't, his eyes are full of tears, and he can't get up to reach the tree, and the giant comes up behind him and lifts him up and puts him in the tree. And the spring, returns to the garden. And the story has kind of goes on a bit from there, but the giant basically kind of grows older in that garden. And what's really interesting about this is that which I find quite touching, is that he's kind of opening himself to the possibility of life, life as it arises. The life has been kind of kept outside by this kind of strong practice, and this is what I should be doing, and this is my life. And when he starts to be more porous and life starts to enter, then the spring comes. But the best thing about this story is that spring then follows summer, and then autumn, and then winter comes again, and so on. And it's a kind of that life appears, in all its kind of myriad forms. And the giant, the giant eventually dies. That's it. And so that's, to me, is like a beautiful kind of rendition of that aspect of being open to life. And the story with Bodhidharma and Eka has this, like I said, this kind of heroic element to it. We're sitting, that energy, that kind of real strong determination. But on the other side of this, is that we, when we sit here, it's like being totally open to life as it is. And I guess the Bodhidharma's response to Eka, when he says, my mind is not at rest, and Bodhidharma says, bring me your mind and I will put it to rest for you. And Eka's response is very telling. He says, I have searched everywhere for my mind and I cannot find it. It's a lovely saying. It's like, I've searched everywhere. I've looked in every nook and cranny of my life. And they say actually the difference between that question, bring me your mind, and where he says, I have searched exhaustively for the mind and I cannot find it. And so that might have been years. It might have gone away. He's given the instruction, bring me your mind, so he goes and tries and finds his mind. What is it to try and find the mind? What is it to try and find something else? So he searches exhaustively for this mind, this awakening. He searches exhaustively for it, and he can't find it. And so Bodhidharma says, there, I have put it to rest for you. I've searched exhaustively for the mind and I cannot find it. So that cannot find it. So that cannot find it. You know, so that long, that kind of heroic search, and then the cannot finding it is, you know, it is this. You know, the children running into the garden, the spring, the summer, the winter, the fall, dying, you know, births, tragedies, Brexit, all kinds of things. You know, but I guess the thing is that the finding that I guess what's important for us too is that aspect of that we need to do the work, and this is the work, you know, that we're doing here. You know, it's that continually applying ourselves to this, you know, to this awakening. And you know, in Sesshin we present ourselves with that opportunity to do that. You know, moment by moment, we're allowing, knocking holes in that big wall that we put around us, and allowing the life to come in. You know, and life doesn't appear as anything apart from, you know, what it appears as, and that is it. But we do the work again and again to remind ourselves that this jewel is like right in our hands. So we've got one full day of session left. So really cultivate that kind of energy that we've developed, which is that relaxation, you know, that faith, that trust, you know, in this basic practice. All right, let's finish.